Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
My guest is Cheryl Head. She is out with a brand new novel. This one is called Time's Undoing. It is available everywhere, and it's a novel that transcends time and place and tells us about, goes back 100 years. And Cheryl, I love this novel because it's two, three, four stories all put together at one, but can you kind of set it up for us? Because the Detroit Free Press did something that not a lot of media places would do this time and age. Let a reporter cover something personal.
That's right. Thank you. I'm glad you enjoyed the book. This is a story set in two time frames. The contemporary protagonist, Megan McKenzie, is a young journalist of the Detroit Free Press. She convinces her editorial team to send her to Birmingham to follow through on the few facts she has about a murder that occurred 90 years before that of her great-grandfather. She covers the Black Lives Matter beat in Detroit and thinks because she's been doing these stories over and over again that she wants to put a human interest element to it that gives some context for how these incidents are systemic. And the 1929 narrative is in the voice of the great-grandfather, Robert Harrington, who is in the last months of his life in Birmingham, which is a boom town at the time in 1929. It's Jim Crow South, of course, segregated South, of course, but Birmingham, Alabama is going through this renaissance because of its steel industry. It's called the Pittsburgh of the South at the time, and we follow Robert and his wife and his young child as they live out their days in Birmingham. I hope the story does justice to the fact that it's based on an element of my personal family tragedy. My grandfather was killed by Birmingham police in 1929.
And I kind of knew that, and that was a fantastic insight into how you got that. But one of the things I found is interesting is this isn't as simple as just going back and going through the police records and things like that. This is looking at newspapers, but specifically newspapers that covered Black issues at the time. And what is, when you set it up here, how did you go about setting up the Black newspapers, what they covered? Because there was politics involved in every aspect of journalism, even almost 100 years ago.
Absolutely right. Those Black newspapers were invaluable to Black communities back in the day. They've been the place where Black communities could go for news about not only world news, but local news and social news and local sports and that kind of thing. Newspapers.com was a valuable resource for me. They don't have everything digitally archived yet, but they're moving through a lot of the newspapers, both current and historical. So I was able to find a couple of Black newspapers produced in Birmingham. There were about a dozen of them, actually, and go through their archives, page after page of news about society goings and daily life and world news and crime and sports, and then just to have insights into how people live through looking at want ads and personal ads and the advertisements for funerals and piano lessons and refrigerators and household goods and that kind of thing. It was really helpful to give me the imagination of the times that I needed, better than any book I read, to tell you the truth, or any film I'd seen. That gave me a good sense of the daily goings-on of the life of then-called Negroes in 1920 Birmingham.
One of the overriding themes throughout this book was this link between secrets and fear, and essentially fear of secrets being revealed. And so when you set about to keep the book along that track, how did you think about the fact that sometimes family secrets, especially this type of family secret, sometimes they're just better left unearthed?
Well, what a great question. Yeah, this is one, however, that has been in my family mythology for decades. So we had very few details about why my grandfather was killed, the circumstances. All we knew from my mother's and grandmother's and my aunt's retellings were the facts that he was killed in Birmingham, and then my family whisked away to St. Pete for fear of retaliation by either the Klan or law enforcement at the time. There wasn't a lot of complaining by Black Americans of law enforcement in 1929, and the Jim Crow laws and the codes of Birmingham were very stringent. And so the stories we heard were really whispers over the decades and little tidbits of information that, you know, became at some point so daunting to me I thought I couldn't write the story. But in the course of doing the research, I was able to uncover some documents that proved the validity of the stories I had heard from my family over the decades. And you're right to point out the fact that it's about secrets. I mean, in the case of the 1929 narrative, the secrets were out of fear of retribution, fear of murder and death. In the contemporary story, the secrets are really about, I think, hanging on to legacy and hanging on to the good things we want to remember about our people, you know, and our communities and our country. You know, I think sometimes those secrets just stand in the way of progress, however.
Something I found interesting is no matter what time frame the book was telling, food played a very important element in the descriptors between the reporter eating food or Robert Harrington eating food. How important was food in Birmingham? Because it seemed like that was all they talked about.
Yeah. You know, Birmingham is a good foodie place. They have these meals called Meat and Threes. I always in my books put food. I guess it's me and foodies, yeah, being a foodie myself. That gives you, however, a real good sense of the flavor of the town, no pun intended. And in the contemporary scenes, you know, the protagonist is doing a lot of cooking and visiting restaurants. Like Detroit, where Megan is from and I'm from, there's some really great ethnic food and really great food that really gives you a sense of the culture. And food is, you know, is one of those things that connect us all. We can sit down at a table, even if we don't agree on politics, and enjoy some, you know, some barbecue or some Chinese food or some vegan offerings. So I do like to sprinkle food throughout my storytelling because I think it's one of the things that keeps the story grounded in the reality and the familiarity we all have as human beings.
I'm chatting with Cheryl Head about her brand new novel, Time's Undoing. It is available everywhere, and it's a fantastic trip into two different time periods to tell a very important story. Cheryl, one thing I noticed about Robert Harrington is he's living his life, and he takes everything in stride. And even when he moved his family from Florida to Birmingham, there was an incident where he picked up a gun the same way we would pick up a cell phone today to protect himself. And trying to draw a character like that, how realistic was that to the, as they were called at the time period, Negroes, to the blacks of the time period, that they were experiencing Jim Crow South, but this was just a way of life, and they couldn't fight the man?
Right. Well, I wanted to make a point about some of the black folks who resisted. I was always told my grandfather was a hearty man, a proud man. I imagined that he would be one of the men who would carry a gun to protect himself and his family. I don't know that for sure, but that was really something I wanted to point out, that there was lots of resistance. We don't often hear the stories of resistance, just the stories of the misery of the life and Jim Crow for black Americans. And I'm not even condoning that someone should have a gun, but I think the reality of it was, for this particular man, in this particular situation, he thought having a gun was necessary to protect himself and his family. Because he made himself pretty visible because he was a flamboyant man who, in the stories I've told, always had the newest car and dressed as a dandy, and so I think he would have protected himself.
Something else I found interesting is the protectiveness that the police in Birmingham had of their secrets and their stories. Mm-hmm. And I always find that interesting because this is something that, from contemporary time, we're talking 90 years ago. Why do you think Birmingham police or anything would be so protective of something that everybody agrees happened at the time? And now it almost seems silly for the police to try to cover something up.
Yeah, I think people, again, it's about legacy. I think people want to forget the bad things that happened. I think that law enforcement still wants to see itself as a little different than kind of the general look at law enforcement now. I am not anti-police, but I do think there should be a consistent look at how we keep law enforcement focused on protecting and serving communities, how we train officers, how we give them sabbaticals. It's a stressful job, so maybe they need sabbaticals more often than other kinds of jobs, but we want to have people in those forces who have compassion, who have empathy, who have a good sense of how to talk to people before they shoot people. And I think that's a secret that some law enforcement departments want to keep now, frankly. But in contemporary times, I think Birmingham wants to reframe itself, and rightly so. It's a beautiful city now. I visited there just as recently as last year, and there's some wonderful people there. But as I say in the book, cities have to live up to their legacy. They can, they can try to be the New South, and I think they are the New South, but they still have to grapple with the truth of their involvement in civil rights atrocities and in Jim Crow legislation and in the way they treated African Americans for hundreds of years.
I would think, just from a pure political standpoint, because police chiefs are by nature political animals, that they would want to own some of these mistakes and say, yeah, but look at how far we've come. And so why do you think that there's that struggle between even pointing out and accepting what happened and using it to say, this is how far we've come?
Well, I mean, look, Brian, at folks who right now want to take textbooks out of classrooms, want to take history out of the hands of teachers so we can't tell the full story of America. I'm not sure why people think that's a good idea to hide these secrets, but I think in elevating them, in illuminating them, in discussing the past of this country, good and bad, it keeps us on a trajectory of progress and living up to the ideals that the Constitution lays out for us. I think we want to do that. I think it's a horrible thing to not remember where we came from, where we started, and how we got here. I think it'll help us in our current divisions and our current cancel culture, that we don't repeat the mistakes we have in the past.
It was Megan McKenzie writing for the Detroit Free Press. I thought it was interesting that she was writing for a newspaper as she did this, because it almost seems like something that you would do research for a book, because newspapers are dying, frankly, around the country. What's the status of them in towns like Detroit? Because those aren't huge cities, but nonetheless, they're not small. Yeah. I mean, Iowa's shrinking and all that stuff, but, Detroit might be the next to go.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of newspapers, and I guess I show my conceit in that. They're changing and have to because of the economies that they face, but there's nothing better for a writer than picking up a hard copy of a newspaper and gleaning through those little bitty articles that don't make TMZ or the nightly news. That's the fodder for novels, I tell you, Brian. And in Detroit, the two major papers, the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News, merged before I left and came and moved to Washington, and I felt something had been lost there, because I think the competition of newspapers in a town really give you a better and fuller story of what makes that town tick. We got a robust paper here in Washington, The Post, and I know Iowa has some papers in Cedar Rapids that I admire. St. Pete Times, the Tampa Bay Times, it's called now. I really admire that paper. I'd love it if they could finding their way back to the prominence they had in the 20th century.
Yeah, it seems like it's a time gone by. But this novel, it was just fantastic. I love the pacing of it. It's called Time's Undoing. It's a brand new novel by Cheryl Head. The book's available everywhere. Pick it up wherever you buy your books. Cheryl, I loved it, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
I appreciate being on. Thank you, Brian.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.
Could you paint me a Birmingham?